Okay, I think we can start. Thank you for coming to this event by the Hellenic Observatory, a book launch on the book Who is to Blame for Greece's Austerity and Change in Charge of Saving a Broken Economy. We have with us the two authors, Professor Thodoros Pelagidis and Dr. Michalis Mitsopoulos. We have the pleasure to have Professor Dimitris Vagianos, our very own LSE from the Department of Finance, who will be discussing aspects of the book. I need to make a couple of announcements before I forget. First of all, this is a book launch, but unfortunately we do not have copies of the book, so in some way it is a bit of a virtual book launch. But I trust you have all received a copy of this leaflet, which contains at the bottom a code that you can use to get a discount for the copy that you can order online. I'm pretty sure there's further details on this leaflet. I'm advised that there's a 30 or 35% discount, so this is the opportunity to use the code and save money.
Wow. Can you call the actor?
Please. Okay, I'm sure we'll cover many of these things as we go along. We're very happy to have Thodoros Pelagidis and Michalis Mitsopoulos here. The two authors, they have written now extensively on the Greek crisis, and they have been following the different phases of the crisis as it has been evolving, not least by various books that they have published together. And I think it's also interesting the titles of the books. First, it was Understanding the Crisis, then it was Talking About Recovery, and now it's a bit more introvert.
With a question mark.
With a question mark, yes. And now it's a bit, so even the question mark and the word recovery left, and a bit more introspectively is looking for who is to blame for the predicament of Greece. Professor Pelagidis is Professor of Economics at the University of Piraeus in Greece. He has studied previously at the University of Aristotle University in Thessaloniki. And got his MPhil from Sussex and then did a PhD at Paris University. He has been visiting and been affiliated to different universities, actually, both in across the world, in the UK including. He was with us a few years back as a professorial fellow, National Bank of Greece professorial fellow, and he's been also a professorial fellow at Columbia University, Fulbright professorial fellow, and also visited... I was visiting a professor also at Harvard University. He has written, as I mentioned already, widely on the Greek crisis, but he has also done wider work both on Greece and on issues of political economy as well as macroeconomics. His co-author, Dr. Michalis Mitsopoulos, is currently coordinator of research and analysis at the Hellenic Federation of Enterprises. He has a PhD from Boston University and has previously worked as a ministerial advisor and also worked in the private sector and the financial sector. He has a long experience on both micro and macroeconomic aspects on the Greek economy and, as I mentioned, also both in the academic world and what we sometimes call the real world outside academia. So his insights on how the economy works and doesn't work, a particular reference to the economy of Greece, is very valuable. As I mentioned, the book they're going to be presenting talks about the austerity policies in Greece and how this may have helped or not the prospects of revitalizing the economy. And Professor Vagianos, on my left, who is going to be discussing the book, has also been working on various aspects of this, not least by his affiliation to an initiative by quite high-profile Greek economists from across the globe, the initiative called Greek Economists for Reform. There is a book, also a collective and edited volume, that comes out from this initiative, I should mention, with the support, with partial support by the Hellenic Observatory, and also looking at issues of structural reform and economic performance. We also have some contributors in the audience, structural reforms and performance in Greece. So he knows very well the case, and I'm sure his comments are going to be very helpful also for the discussion that would follow. We have agreed that each speaker will keep exactly to the time allocated. I will not mention how much so that I don't get disproved about my timekeeping. So without further ado, let me pass the floor to Thodoros Pelagidis.
Thank you.
Greece's economy, an effort to raise the critical questions, juxtaposed on who's to blame for Greece, who's to blame for this mess after 7 years of crisis. We would like also to thank a distinguished member of the LSE, Professor Vaginos, for accepting to comment on the book. So, these are the key questions of the presentation. Were Greek politicians aware of course, for Greece to join the single currency and the reform that should be done at the time? We mainly focus on the period 1990-1993. What did the IMF say about the euro accession of Greece and its performance? We investigate the role of the creditors. Third, to what extent the current mess is explained by a dysfunctional political market and the rise of political, let's say, extremism. We try to see also some kind of connection between debt sustainability and political market risk, if they are connected, etc. In the second part of the presentation, Michael will focus on exports, on contract labor and tax reforms, and on political risk in Europe, a very important and timely topic, which is hopefully open the Q&A. First of all, don't be afraid. It's a couple of words for our political economy approach. We believe that Greece is a par excellence, a classic example of a rent seeking economy, where extracting rent has become over the years the dominant economic activity. This is, in other words, the trade of favors between vested interests, the so called Vikings, the planetary state, the personal rule, the lack of meritocracy, the distorted institutions, the closeness of the markets, the so-called rigidities, and the extraction of rents by the clubs, by the redistributed groups. These are only some of the features highlighted by the so-called economic analysis of non-market decision-making, the public choice theory, the American public choice theory, which we believe that fits very well to the Greek case. We now believe that this is our third book, as Vasily said. This is, we believe now that there's now a coherent and robust body of books and there are three books in English and three in Greek of books and papers that offer a full picture of the structures and distortions of Greece's economy, going beyond and above the, any single, let's say, description of the current situation. Bearing in mind our approach, we proceed in investigating the role of domestic politics. Yeah, during the 90s, this is chapter 3 of the book. We offer the historical analysis of the Greek political market and a Greek politician's view in particular regarding the cost and benefits of Greece's economy joining the euro area at the time. We use material from various sources, from classified and unclassified documents, I should say that right now, and we pay particular emphasis to the 1990-1993 period, the so-called Mitsotakis government, as only Featherstone, Kazamias, and Papa Dimitriou have done in the past. Let me just give you some extras from our fieldwork regarding this chapter on the following five topics. On fiscal adjustment, Mr. Mitsotakis at the time, where all the critical decisions have been taken, about Greece's accession to the Eurozone. Greece has to restore stability, reduce deficits, public debt, inflation, and interest rates. Mr. Samaras, FDI has to be attracted by the economy. Mr. Manos argued that the debt has to be reduced because it is an unbearable burden of the economy. He said that the interest paid on the debt takes away funds from defense, security, social cohesion, and education, with very negative implications. The fiscal adjustment needed so large that it needs to include cuts in government, personal costs, transfers, and other expenses. That reminds the current problem. On EMU membership, Listen to that, it's very important, it's very critical. Mr. Papandreou, in the common currency area, interest rates would no longer be an available tool in the case of shocks. Then Mr. Papandreou provided a long analysis of the fact that member countries not having access to the tools of inflation, exchange rate, and fiscal control cannot deal anymore with the regional shock. This is the optimum currency area theory, actually. On taxation, Mr. Manos, it's not possible anymore to maintain a situation in which so many groups of Greeks do not pay taxes. Read the Vikings, the vested interests. Mr. Papandreou asked for the shadow, Andreas Papandreou. The shadow economy has to be reduced. Mr. Manos, he listed a number of structural reforms to be implemented, which actually are almost aligned with reforms included in the current bailout programs. On vested interests and institutions, Mr. Simitis, without modernizing the institutions of the country, the cohesion funds influence would be wasted and only spent on friends. Yes. Mr. Mitsotakis argues that productivity has to be increased by removing distortions, outdated practices, and unacceptable legislative privileges. And on future unemployment, Mr. Papandreou makes a prediction that unemployment trends lead to an unemployment rate of 15% at the time. So the apparent conclusion is that evidently they knew, but what? And why? Our approach, our explanation is that the Vikings had become so powerful, the Vikings had become so powerful, after succeeding in creating an environment in which they were able to extract the so-called rent, the rentier economy. They captured the state. They captured the institutions. They captured mainly the political parties. And the result was that the political market finally was producing bills mostly to serve the redistributed group's interests, the Vikings' interests. What about the creditors? As for the creditors in the period 1995-2008, we went also to documents classified and unclassified again, working papers and records to the Greek government during the whole period. Our view is that the IMF kept stressing the problems in all periods, but offered rather mild expressions, and that happened also in 2007-2008, when most of the analysts began to understand that crisis was coming. As for the 2012, these flaws are very well known now of the first program, that targets were unfeasible, the Troika did not press the government to materialize the structural reforms, the details of the program. The government imposed horizontal tax increases, and it exaggerated in cutting wages in an horizontal way also. It ignored for too long non-wage costs, in spite of the hard evidence that they were the main problem for the productive economy. And in our view, the worst of all, they used Brexit talk as a negotiating instrument. Both the creditors and the government also, from their part, which is exactly where we would like to focus and be connected with the political market, the political risk. Because Brexit talk comes with a price. And it is not only that it destroys a large part of the productive economy, that is the tax base of the economy. It also feeds domestic political, should I say that, extremism. And political risk, in any case, which in turn destroys the prospects of any prospects of recovery. There is some phrases, extracts from Brexit talk. When you upload the paper, then the audience will have the opportunity to. Mr. Schäuble is the superstar here. Let's talk about Brexit and risk. Third part. Well, this is a first glance on the massive financial assistance to Greece compared to peers. Cannot be compared, as you can see for yourself. Almost 200 billion against 52 and 40, etc., and 9 for Cyprus. And this is now with the third program, but at the end of December, this is total financial assistance as of December 2015, which is about, if you add the numbers, 237 over there. And the financial support as of August 2018, which is something like 302 billion minus reimbursements. So we have a number now here, 278.4, isn't it, Paul? Yeah. All right. And for those of you, questioning what exactly all this money finance, you see for yourself that almost 60 billion, this is the fifth line, went to finance budget deficits. Agree? This is just to show to you that for both periods, 2009 and the crisis period, 2010-2013, according to Rogoff and Bulow, for both periods, net cash flows to Greece are positive. But turn negative in 2014, minus 5.5, as Greece had to make payments on some long terms, and the Samaras administration, this lovely guy, felt political pressure to back away from Troika program requirements, even at the cost of postponing the receipt of bailout funds. This is also what happened in the first 6 months of 2015. So, a small wrap up here, almost 400 billion, because you have to add the emergency liquidity assistance here. Almost 400 billion has been given to Greece, but I guess that you are going to agree with me that with rather poor results. Another thing to say here is that when we stop to negotiate, when we deny conditionality, when we stop reforms, there is a net outflow, part of 2014 and part of 2015. 2016, in my view, is a year of recession because there are still substantial new agreements. What else? Brexit talk is in no agreement periods brings some kind of political turbulence, political extremism, which brings in turn loss of credibility, which damages in turn again the prospects of recovery. So what is the cost? What is the cost of non-agreement periods? Who's to blame for Brexit? Who's to blame for Brexit? The creditors that threaten the government with Brexit, but also the government that is so reluctant to implement reform. Professor Prowse, I do. So glad to see you. He loves the Brexit talk. Again, Brexit comes with no agreement periods. Is it 2016 a bizarre year? Nobody knows. This is something for Dimitri. This is the figure depicts the price of political turbulence on financial markets in general. The political, according to Pastor Veronese and etc. etc. The political risk premium, which is depicted in with a red color here, is actually larger when prevailing degree of political acceptance is high, and it is also larger in poor economic conditions, when you are a country in recession. All right? Political shocks can have a large impact on stock prices, and then on, we agree with me, on the real economy, of course, I guess. And political uncertainty depresses investment and real activity by raising the firm's cost of capital and destroys market value. This is a cost of capital table. Greece and Cyprus on the right with almost 80% higher interest rates than the peers. This is interest rates, national difference with euro area average. Alright. As for the rise of political extremists, political extremists, which is expressed with votes for the far right parties that increase strongly, government majorities that shrink, fractionalization of parliament, this is the fourth figure, that rises, and overall number of parties represented in the parliament that jumps, deteriorates seriously economic performance in turn.
These are years. The x-axis is years. The x-axis is what?
the exact is this a vector that expresses the no, it's not here, it's the kind of it's a vector that estimates the number of the parties, for example, in the parliament, etc.
So this is different parliaments, isn't it?
No, it's an average. It's not for Greece. It's in general. It's in general. So number of parties increase when, you know, we have some kind of political turbulence due to economic crisis. The fractionalization of parliament again increases, etc.
It's a function of what? What is in the x-axis? The x-axis. The, what is on the x-axis?
What is 0 to 5?
I don't know. It's a. I mean, I don't know the exact composite of the vector.
Oh, I see. So it's a vector of all these things?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Because it's not mine. I mean, I haven't constructed the vector. So my argument here is that this is the case of Greece. I mean, it fits very well to Greece. So that's why I present 5 minutes. We have tried with Mike to construct a couple of slides, trying to see whether employment and political uncertainty are correlated. So this figure correlates unemployment and political uncertainty. It shows a positive correlation, of course. This is not the only factor, but you know, there's a kind of, you know, positive correlation between them, and breaks down the political periods and tries to correlate it with unemployment. And then here we have the interest rates, which is the thin line over there. So you get the higher the turbulence, the higher the political extremes, the higher the interest rates, the higher the unemployment, the lower the employment. Well, we're working on this kind of things that are very interesting. I mean, the connection of political market with economy is now very, you know, very, very sexy. And the political extremism, political risk has important repercussions on what? On interest rates? On interest rates, on asset prices, on employment, on growth, on income. And it can be and can destroy the coverage by killing the number one Keynesian priority, which is increasing demand by business confidence. This is the confidence. This is exactly what the newspaper Economist has said last month, that this is about the real Brexit, destroying through the political market the business confidence. And the chances for recovery. This is what we need, after all, right now. Well, and a couple of slides regarding two slides on debt sustainability and political risk. Again, try to correlate political risk with debt. And there's so much talk about debt. This table depicts Greece's advantageous position compared to Greece, as far as what interest payments, the lower interest payments. Principal payments, again, look at the peers, make the comparison. It's amazing. Debt service, amount and funding. And it shows that debt is not an issue if the economy recovers. However, Greek borrowing cost is now more than Is it 1,100, Paul? The BPS? Yeah. Higher. Although numbers are even better if you use the present value instead of future face value. And this is a projection for the next 10 years. Look at the numbers again. Debt service percentage of GDP, 7%. The peer average, 12%. Net interest percentage of GDP, 2.6%. Is it the lowest in the world? Right? So, what to do and what not to do. So, again, it's political risk that makes that to appear unsustainable, in my view. So, dear Syriza, no need to negotiate so long to get some debt relief and to tell to the voters that, well, we got that as an exchange for austerity. Just advertise the investment opportunities in the country. And this is a very nice phrase from Reuters. Yes,
sir. Thank you.
Haven't finished. This is much more interesting than the political stuff. Okay.
So, yeah. I'm going to fly through this, but I'm going to make some points that are in the book, and then I think we can revisit some of the issues in the discussion. So the first thing is exports. There were a lot of people saying that the Greek economy doesn't adjust during the crisis. Exports are not going up.
Who?
Daniel Gross.
Say that, please.
Other people influence public opinion. So what we argue in the book is that you had key sectors that were undermined by specific policy decisions that were often Troika sanctioned. For example, here you have the exports in 2007, they go down in all the world, and then they recover. The fat line is energy-intensive exports, commodities, steel and textiles. And then it's non-fuel other products that are not that energy-intensive, even though you have movements that are affected by various policy decisions. But as an aggregate, you can see they're moving up, and in 2015 it's even stronger. But what happened here is that here they implemented a new tax on energy for industrial use. So suddenly the cost of energy for steel mills that have like 50% of the cost is energy. It was like double of what the cost of competitors in Italy and Germany is, or four times the cost of what it is in Turkey, say, for example. And what happened with the commodities, basically nil. I mean, they shut down, the lid of people. And that's about 1 billion of exports lost every year. Only from these two sectors. So what happened here is that specific policies like the tax increase on energy for industrial use, it basically killed off exports. And when you had some sectors going up and then this going down, you saw the aggregate flat, and then you had this mystery, Daniel Gross coming out and saying Greece does not promote exports during the crisis, in comparison with Portugal. So the myth that Greeks were failing to increase exports is busted. Because when you gave them the opportunity and you did not actively make it impossible for them to export, they actually were increasing exports during the crisis than all the other countries were doing. Now, there was much talk about labor market reforms. There was a lot of resistance in Greece. And people were saying Greece doesn't need them. And what experience showed that in basically, I'm going to skip through these. These graphs show how actually SMEs basically used the flexibility of these reforms. But I'm going to come to this graph here. So the fat line is percentage change in private sector employment. And here you have private sector wages. It's the dotted line. And what you see is that from the beginning to the crisis up to 2012, wages did not decrease, but employment was decreasing. And then in the beginning of 2012, you have the new laws, but they actually had the transition period. They kicked in after the spring of 2012. And what happens is that wages go down and the employment starts recovering. And it even turns positive. So actually, labor market reforms worked like in the Mario Draghi, Jackson Hole speech. They also worked in other countries exactly the way they should work. It is they preserved jobs, and they shifted the adjustments towards wages. I mean, among two evils, it's better to have a lower-paying job than having no job at all. So this myth that labor market reforms are relevant in Greece, it's also busted. Now, for product market reforms, I'm going to fly through this, but the key point here is that Greece basically remains more regulated than the average EU country. Okay, and here it's the other way down. But it also made a lot of progress. You see here it's closing in, and here it's also moving away from the bottom towards the average of the Eurozone. So Greece did a lot, but it still has a lot of to do. So both the statements, Greece did nothing and it has no more to do, it's also busted. Now, I'm going to taxes, which is a core to the political system. It's how taxes are distributed. I recall the citation from when the Maastricht Treaty was ratified in the Greek Parliament, that it is not sustainable that so few Greeks pay all the taxes and so many pay nothing. So what we have in Greece is that taxes are both too high and too low. And that's the sick man of Europe syndrome. It's what Ireland had some time ago, which means that you have personal income taxes to GDP ratio is low, so the state as a percentage of GDP collects little amounts of money, too little. But if you take the tax wage, and that's as a percentage of the average national wage, you can see that Greece, first of all, the social security contributions are like 10 percentage points higher than the OECD average. There are some low tax countries here, but this is comparable with the high tax countries that, of course, offer a different institutional and political quality to the economy. So here you pay the money like you pay Swedish taxes, but you get... I don't know what I have to compare this with. And then this here is flat because you have a very high tax-free threshold, which you don't have in other OECD countries.
Yeah.
And then you have the progressive tax.
Yeah, but that's very, very important. It's progressive, too progressive.
What does this do? So here you have the social security that's on the bars, and here the personal income tax starts to kick in with the progressive scale. And then here you have the distribution of declared incomes and the individuals. And what you see is basically the whole distribution shifts in the area between the minimum wage and where the progressive taxation builds on top of the social security contributions. And you have the whole mass of private sector wages squeezed in here. So it really shows you how the market reacts to it. And if you wonder what this is, here the social security contributions, they have a cap, so they flatten out, so the percentage reduces. And then you see suddenly here, pop, it pops up again. So it really shows you how the market reacts to the incentive the tax system gives you.
You see here, this is ICA data.
So yeah, ICA is the private sector social security fund.
Sorry, so is this data only for wage earners in the private sector?
Yeah, I mean, the public sector employees are out.
Yeah.
Are not, public sector employees are
out.
Self-employed.
And self-employed are not wage earners, so they are not here. And, of course, the high taxation, it's not only that you have the reaction here, and thank you for the question, I forgot to mention this, but of course you have then a lot of people also that move away from waged labor, and they go into self-employment, and where they have the opportunity to debate taxes, but which also creates you a productivity problem in the economy, because 10,000 self-employed can't make you a Boeing airplane or an Airbus airplane. 10,000 employees in a structured company can make you a Boeing or an Airbus airplane. So this is like the profilization of SMEs is actually a drag on productivity. And these are in, I don't remember if it's in this book or in the previous one, but we have covered it. But I'm coming here back to the myth that rich Greeks do not pay taxes.
Look at that.
So in this is 2015, data that has been leaked, all of Greece has it, it's not officially published, but anyhow you can get it from the newspapers. And what it tells you from the 8.5 people who filed a tax return, I'm summing the cumulative percentage upwards here to make the point, 10%, that's about 800,000 if you add this, 10% of the taxpayers paid, declared 40% of
almost
income and paid 65% of the taxes. Now you can read it the other way. It's like 90% of the taxes have been paid by these guys, so you have half. It's the difference between half of the taxpayers pay less, something more than 5% of the taxes. So rich people don't pay taxes. Is adding insult to injury to these 10% of the high-earning Greeks that earn over 20,000 euros and that pay like 64% of the personal income taxes and the extraordinary level. So I think this is double busted.
Didn't you say those people who declared their tax? What about all the people in Greece?
This is for those who pay taxes.
Yeah.
So when they increase now, that
pay tax, as you pointed out, the ones who declared their taxes.
Yeah, but that was mainly back in 2009, sir. I mean,
yeah,
that was back in 2009, 2010. It's not so easy to evade taxation today in Greece.
You can evade if you have a big public sector.
The self-employed, for example, what? Yeah.
But with the self-employed,
but they got busted.
Happened.
Even the self-employed got busted.
Yeah, what has happened?
No one left to evade taxation right now.
They don't evade taxes anymore because they don't have any black income not to declare. You know, their income. The lawyers have a lot of customers, but they don't pay them. So they don't earn any black income because nobody pays them anymore. Everyone tells them, I have this this case with the tax authorities, help me, and I'll pay you later. They're actually collecting no money.
Is the first column the declared income, declared by the taxpayer?
Taxpayers?
First,
declared income and the taxes paid. And then next to them is it's the cumulative percentage up to 100%.
If they declare their income, they pay the taxes.
Of course.
Yes, of course. Kind of both.
Yes, of course.
What the income that they don't declare is a question.
The income you don't declare, it pays zero
tax.
They
go and investigate your deposit. It's not so easy to evade taxation.
Okay, we will have time at the end to have a discussion about it, so let's proceed with the process.
I mean, I'm to stereotype.
What happens now here is that all this overtaxation on those who earn more money, who basically are asked to pay for everything, gives a huge incentive to the talented and smart young to move away. And ILCAP has made a survey on those who have left Greece during the crisis. They estimated about 200,000 in the migration data. It's something like 130,000. Anyhow, you can argue about this if you count the people who study or not. The bottom line is, if they were asked in the survey with what salary they would come back, and if you took that and you multiplied it with the taxes and the tax rates and the social security contributions they would pay, that's only the direct taxes, no indirect taxes. It is those that would come back at the salary they would be willing to come back if they were in Greece and were paying their taxes. Out of these 200,000, it's 2 billion. That's not all of them coming back, right? It's those that would come back that I've multiplied here. It's 2 billion a year. So that's your fiscal gap. And what do they need and what does the country need to stop this? You need a stable, reasonable, and credible tax regime, and that has to be agreed by both the creditors and the government. And if you can't get that, the talent will keep leaving the country, no investment will come, it won't fly. So this is now a key ingredient because tax is very low trust. So, okay, financing the private sector. Andrew Mellon would approve, you just revived 1929, but he wouldn't disapprove of overtaxation if you look at the history. So this, again, I want to say this now is medium term, this is 5 or 7 years, this is not short term anymore. And this is a small regression in employment in manufacturing, real interest rates, good market efficiency, and the wage. And basically what it tells us is that whatever we won from the fall in wages, we lost from the interest rates. And again, here, Daniel Gross says it's not important, but because he's looking at the World Economic Forum survey that goes to big companies, but for the SMEs, they have no financing, they're dying out. Look at the ECB survey, they do not even apply for loans. And restoring financing to viable terms is key to give the opportunity to the structural reforms and the wage declines to yield results. Now what you have done some reforms, you have reduced wages, but you cannot see the positive side because the uncertainty that goes through the cost of financing kills off the potential of these developments. So the idea that financing, access to finance for the private sector is a secondary problem, like it is in the way the MOUs are written, this thesis, I think, is also busted. Now, political risk, how am I going to fly through this? Basically, it puts you on a self-fulfilling prophecy through exit. And what I'm arguing here and what the book tries to argue is that while you have done a lot of other things in the past years in Europe, what you have not done is to get it closer together on the convergence of institutions so that you have made very minor steps towards the single market, and those you have cancelled out by the fears that you're going to fall apart. And ask me later in the discussion about Quebec.
Yeah, but
the bottom line is you should try harder to reduce the regulatory divergence among member states. So being a European individual or company should mean more similar things in basic dimensions, like the rule of law and the application of EU law for in the daily life of businesses across the Europe. And this means not more EU legislation, it means a more even application of basic legislation. And I can give you later examples if you want. So it means more of a Europe that focuses on basic principles, that EU law means the same thing across Europe, and less trying to coordinate it financially the countries. And if you can focus on that, we argue, and we think we have a proposition about that in the book, how you can achieve that, then actually there should be no reason to leave Europe under this stress. Ours is now the least for Greece. So what we're trying to bust here, and I think that everyone starts agreeing on that, is that only advancing, say, the financial, the banking union, the fiscal union for Europe is not enough. You have to also advance the economic union, another very good Mario Draghi speech in Helsinki. Actually, I finished.
Very good. Thank you, Michalou. As I mentioned, we have in a couple of days the European Institute host Schäuble, who is going to talk also about related things. I'm not sure he's going to agree exactly with the idea of an economic union before structural reform. But we have now a discussant, Dimitris Vagianos, who's going to comment on some aspects of the book. I'm sure you saw by now the book covers very many things, and some of them in great detail. Dimitri, we're looking at something within 10, 15 minutes.
All right, so thanks a lot for inviting me to discuss this book. Okay, so as the book title kind of indicates, the book is about why Greece's adjustment has failed. Some program. So it has three main parts. Actually, it covers quite a bit of material in kind of different parts. So first of all, it's about policy thinking in Greece before euro adoption, and also there's an extensive comparison with some adjustment efforts that were took place in between 90 and 93, when Greece also had a big debt and kind of had difficulty financing it because interest rates were very high at the time. So there was also some effort to kind of do some structural reforms at the time. Then in part two, there is a review of policy actions undertaken during the adjustment program between 2010 and 2014, mostly. And then part three actually goes in quite some detail on the question on why internal devaluation failed to kickstart export-led growth. And actually, these are some of the graphs that we saw in the second part of the presentation, about exports and taxes, etc., were kind of spoke to that. Now, I think that the book has the analysis is very insightful in the book, and there's lots of useful information, also quite a bit of anecdotal information about the reforms, which worked, which did not, why, etc. So kind of is interesting stuff to read. So I have not seen several of the tables that we saw in the presentation, so I would, and some which were very interesting, and I would have liked to have more time to comment on them, so I would comment mainly on what is in the book. So I will mainly try to reinforce some of the arguments in the book, or try to explain them a bit more, and also kind of some of the concerns that the authors kind of clearly have about Greece's current situation. So, just in case that there are in the audience there are some non-Greeks and maybe not so familiar with the kind of Greece's current plight, let me say that obviously Greece has experienced a significant economic decline. It's also useful to put it in relative terms. Greece was, in terms of GDP per capita, in real terms, and the PPP adjusted, I mean, adjusted for purchasing power parity, was 13 in the EU 28 in 1985. It dropped to 19th in 2015. So it has been overtaken by some countries just recently because of the drop in GDP, like the Czech Republic and Slovakia, but also Estonia, but also by some countries quite a bit earlier on, like Ireland. Ireland now has about twice the GDP of per capita of Greece. And Spain. So, kind of there is a decline kind of going on. And at least as worrisome is the fact that kind of if you want to look forward, is that Greece has ranked poorly when compared to the same group of countries on the determinants of long-run growth, such as institutional quality and innovation and R&D. So just here are just a few rankings that I put together. So, for example, okay, Michalis, I think, talked about, in the ease of doing business, Greece has improved quite a bit over the past few years, kind of this ranking on how, whatever, various factors that characterize how easy it is to do business, but still remains close, very close to the bottom of the EU28, it's 26th out of 28 countries. An index of kind of the quality and the how heavy product market regulation is also attached to the presentation, 31st within the 34 OECD countries as of 2013. The efficiency of courts measures kind of court delays, cost of kind of putting cases through courts is 27th in the EU28.
Who is worst?
In this one, Cyprus, actually.
No way!
Yes. So, and then even on education, I mean, even though kind of Greek households spend quite a bit there are high out-of-pocket expenses for education, the percent of population having completed the secondary education is, okay, Greece is kind of below the OECD median, 24th among the OECD 31 countries at the time, 2007. PISA test also not doing very well. R&D expenditure as percent of GDP, 29th within the OECD 31. So these are kind of determinants of long-run growth, and this thing really need to be addressed going forward.
And this,
otherwise,
is, and this is mostly public R&D, right?
This is total R&D expenditure.
Yeah. Public, not private.
I think it was what OECD reports, and my understanding was that this was total, but I mean,
the greatest fraction is public.
The most of it is public. Okay, I see.
Yeah, it's the third chapter of the Brookings book.
Of the Brookings book. You see, that's the thing, I have to become an expert in bibliography. So, okay. All right, so then, now let me go more straight to the book. I mean, this is more kind of expressing a concern about the future. Now, let me go to your main question, which is kind of who is to blame. And here I wanted to kind of provide a bit of perspective by putting Greece's economic fundamentals prior to the crisis, kind of some macro fundamentals. So this is the Greece's trade deficit prior to the crisis in 2007. So in this, Greece compared with Spain, Italy, and Portugal. So Greece had a significantly larger trade deficit, although Spain and Portugal had a sizable one. This is total net indebtedness to foreigners. So actually, this should be a plus sign here. So anyway, so that's debt, in other words.
Yeah.
So Greece was a bit worse. I mean, comparable to Spain and Portugal, just a bit worse. Greece was significantly worse than Spain and Portugal was that government finances were worse, even though on that respect it was in terms of government debt, not a government deficit. Government savings is a bit like the opposite of government deficit. I mean, it's closely related to that. So in terms of government debt, it was a bit similar to Italy. And where it was doing a bit better than Spain and Portugal was the private sector credit, so loans of domestic banks, domestic firms and households as percent of GDP. This was actually quite comparable to Italy in that regard. But overall, Greece's fundamentals were worse than those of the other southern countries, and which means that okay, we can be tough and of criticize the adjustment program, but also say that designing an adjustment program with these kind of fundamentals was quite a challenge, and a drop in GDP smaller than 15% would have been kind of unlikely, given at least how the other countries did. Maybe one can argue that all countries had a ill-designed kind of adjustment. But relative to the other countries, Greece kind of was bound, in some sense, given its fundamentals, to have done somewhat worse. But I mean, it's probably right that a GDP decline of 26, all the way to 26.3% was overly large. And so indeed there were shortcomings in the response program, as the book emphasizes, and as I would come back to them. So actually the book emphasizes quite a lot this issue of internal devaluation, that it led to an overly large decline in GDP, and I will come back to internal devaluation as well.
Yeah.
So it emphasizes the fact that tax rises were overly there was too much reliance on tax rises relative to expenditure cuts, especially the early part of the program, which is a very
critical
point. Yeah, but to some extent also there was the program ended up at least in its implementation relying too much on fiscal adjustment relative to structural reforms, and also this other issue that somehow the book kind of assumes more or less, but I think it's good to emphasize it as well, which is that there was a lack of domestic ownership. I would talk a little bit about that. Now, again, let's put a bit of perspective. I mean, there was also some successes, which is that adjustment did happen. So Greece managed to kind of close its trade deficit and its budget deficit by 2014,
yes.
Almost closed them. It did remain in the Eurozone, at least for now.
Despite Brexit.
And despite all this kind of talk, et cetera, so it, kind of this was a success, an important success. Some structural reforms did take place, as you argued in the book. And actually also the banking system, despite becoming completely insolvent, all banks were insolvent, was recapitalized successfully. So all this, and this was not, all these things were not easy. I mean, like, just have all the banks being insolvent and kind of get the banking system back to work again in some form. Now, let me look a bit about internal devaluation. I think that's kind of the most interesting bit. It's one of the most interesting bits, let's say, from an economic viewpoint, which is kind of essentially what happened here and why did things not work well. So Greece had to adjust to a zero trade deficit. So it had this 12% trade deficit in 2007.
And more,
So wages and prices had to fall. They had gone up quite a lot to kind of as a consequence of demand stimuli since euro entry. So they had to fall. And what would be the what should have been the economic mechanisms at play? The dropping price would have made exports more competitive and imports less competitive. So therefore, Greece would have exported more, imported less. And there's an additional effect, which is that the kind of domestic demand effect, that the drop in wages reduces domestic demand, including for imports. So these are the, so for those mathematically inclined, that's the equation. Exports had to become equal to imports. A price drop would have made exports, would have increased exports. A drop in price in Greece, it would also have reduced imports because Greeks would have been consuming more of imported goods, and the drop in wages would also have reduced imports. So that's the theory. And somehow, the Troika did opt for policies that reduced domestic wages. This was the internal devaluation, in the expectation that this would reduce domestic prices. So there was quite a bit of emphasis on labor market deregulation in particular. I mean, not just to achieve the internal devaluation, but in general to kind of for other means as well. But actually, there was this beautiful figure that Mihaly showed us that. Anyway, so what happens, and now I'm drawing on some data. I will give the source in the next slide by, actually, Manolis Galenianos has a chapter in our book. I will give the source in the next chapter. So this is the decline in wages between 2007 and 2012, and the decline in prices. And again, Greece compared to Spain, Ireland, and Portugal. So wages declined quite a lot in Greece by 13%. So adjustment took place on that margin, but prices actually did not decline. Actually, they barely increased between 2007 and 2012. So all this big decline in wages did not have the effect. This has something
This is accumulated percentage or what?
This is decline, cumulative.
I mean,
cumulative.
Of course, for the period 2010-2012, it's plus 10% because of the rigidities of the market. So the minus two, it's an estimation between 2007 and 2012. Yes.
An increase in prices.
And I know that,
To manage to an increase in prices.
And actually, these numbers, that's right. So this is, this is an increase.
Everything has
a minus sign here.
Yeah, but it's too little. That's why I mind.
It's
not an average, it's accumulated.
Limited 4 minutes.
Okay, sorry.
So anyway, so Manolis can vouch for that, so I will let him defend and actually, the decline in wages was even larger if we go to 2013 and 14. So somehow this equation somehow failed to work. So this is so prices did not move. So exports and imports to become equal, all the work had to be done by wages.
Yeah.
So wages had to fall and fall and fall to kind of ensure that domestic demand would equal. The domestic demand would be so low so that imports could drop so much and to become kind of to balance with exports. And this is the graph that
account zero.
This is actually a beautiful graph from the chap Arkonakis, Doxiadis, and Galinianos. So Manolis, who is here in our forthcoming book.
Yeah, I saw that.
That shows that somehow how the adjustment worked. So so this is Greece compared with Ireland, Portugal, and Spain. So in Greece, most of the trade deficit was eliminated through reduction in imports, all of it. Actually, exports worked between 2007 and 2012, worked in the opposite direction, just slightly decline. In Ireland, it was the exact opposite. And in Portugal and Spain, exports did about 2/3 of the work. So, and because in that chapter, they actually employ a structural model to estimate what should have happened and kind of how GDP and exports and import dynamics were related, they find that had exports adjusted by the amount, by kind of the due amount, so to speak, the amount that they kind of should have happened according to kind of to the model, then the drop in GDP would have been about at least 1/3 lower. So instead of 26%, it would have been 18%. So somehow, the lack of response of exports was a significant problem, which this is really emphasized in the book. So what should have, so the book is very good in kind of also, among other things, in analyzing the reasons why exports did not adjust. So they talk about this taxation issue, taxing inputs, they talk about labor taxes, they talk about product market rigidities. So what should have done differently? I mean, that's the corollary of what he said in the book, and they kind of go through that in some detail. Product market reforms should have been given greater emphasis earlier in the program, in addition to labor market reforms, which were given emphasis. Investment was hampered by a lack of access to finance, and also by kind of very damaging uncertainty about euro exit. So this prevented kind of entry in markets by new firms, which could have kind of stimulated competition and lowered prices. Corporate tax burdens actually became higher, including labor tax. So the book kind of will give you lots of material on these issues. Now, let me talk a little bit about ownership. So, I mean, we cannot blame everything on the program's design. So the essentially, for the program to succeed and whatever happens in the future to succeed, it has to be that there is a significant majority in favor, domestic, in favor of reforms. It cannot be that things are imposed by outside and are going to happen. So, and obviously, as we know, none of the big political parties sought to explain to voters why adjustment was necessary and reforms were beneficial. Actually, I think it's telling that the most ambitious reforms were not the ones that were required in the adjustment program, but they were the ones that were designed domestically without any pressure by outsiders, like the reform of higher education. Also, lack of domestic ownership meant inadequate implementation of reforms, and there are many examples of that that I don't have time to get into. This lack of ownership was exacerbated by a perception that the program was missing its targets. And because maybe in some cases they were overly ambitious targets, some cases they were design shortcomings of the program that were causing these failures. But somehow the two kind of worked in a vicious circle. So just to recap, so obviously the adjustment program had failures, had also some successes. The failures concerned both the program's design, so it should be built to the Troika, although admittedly Greece would have come up also with some alternative design, and it did not. So there was just one design on the table, and as well as its implementation. The book provides an insightful analysis into these issues and lots of useful data. So what in this academic seminar sometimes we talk about forthcoming research, kind of new research and the kind of things to do in future research. So I think it's very interesting to dig more into political economy aspects, and kind of there has been some work by these authors in the past on these issues. In particular, how to design and sequence reforms so that there is enough domestic support and ownership. So I think that this is a really interesting question. How can kind of the Vikings be overcome in your language? And I think that's really kind of the question for one of the questions for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right. I want to give the authors the opportunity to pick up any points from the discussion, but we have very little time left for questions and answers, so I will collect also some questions from the audience, and then the authors can, if they want, also pick up any of the points that Dimitris mentioned. So I'll take a question here.
Very short question.
Okay, but use the mic, please. Okay.
Short question. Who is to blame?
Okay.
We just raised...
yeah, and the question by Konstantin. Okay.
Why don't you give names in your book?
These are very short questions, so we'll take a third one from here. And then you can spend the whole evening answering.
given the importance of debt and debt metrics to all the discussion, whether it's Schäuble or whether it's debt to GDP, it is the central issue of debt, and it's compared to peers, why hasn't any of the governments brought in professionals who correctly manage debt numbers to show what they actually are. Who's to blame for that? And the current government...
This is kind of a blame game.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Who's to blame? It takes two to tango, both the government and the creditors. To what extent? It's not easy to...
What is to blame? Is it finance? It's not
Platon, it's many things. I mean, it's the bad design of the program. You have to separate the periods. For example, during 2010-2012, you had a nice program, but very bad implementation. You had the urgency to save the large, too big to fail European banks, and then you let the government and let the government of Mr. Papandreou to kick the can down the road. So these are different periods, and these are, you know, different, let's say, in a way... Different ways to put the blame on both of them, because, for example, yes, you have to blame more the government of Mr. Papandreou, but if you take into account that, you know, the creditors got the money, they could have done it better, they could have, you know, succeed some more reforms. Dimitri has shown that, for example, there was not at all, especially during the period 2010-2012, there was a cumulative increase of inflation of prices 10%. How do you expect to have this program to be successful when you target internal devaluation and you have, despite the fact that you have a decrease in wages, you have an increase in prices? Who's to blame for that? Well, both of them, but it depends, you know. On the other periods... The second program, the PSI was something. I mean, it saved the country from the total chaos, because, you know, we were facing the Brexit. It could be very important to, since you will hospitalize Mr. Schäuble, to tell him whether the Brexit talk was a negotiating instrument. That was a mistake, of course. Or it was... As Mr. Venizelos have disclosed one month ago, it was a reality, it was a real plan, because I think that from the disclosure of the dialogue, both Mr. Schäuble and Mr. Rasmussen had told to Venizelos, who was at the time the finance minister, that they had a plan. That plan was named Brexit, and the plan was to impose capital controls and to be able to get only 50 euros per week. And then if you have a deposit, the first 3,000 from the deposit would be in euros and the other in undervalued drachmas by 70%. So that was real kind of a negotiating instrument to make the government to implement the program, because they failed to do it otherwise? Or was it a reality? So we aim to raise the critical questions more, not to, you know, put the blame on just the Troika or just Mr. Papandreou and Mr. Samaras and the Syriza, of course. But what is happening now is something which should be discussed in another panel, I think. I mean, it's a different story there.
I want to add to that. What is yes, the thing with the Brexit talk, I think when Greece went and questioned the no bailout clause in 2010, and then it didn't deliver, very soon some started to say, okay, you question the no bailout clause, we question the you're in and don't get out clause. So this is like the two pillars of the treaty. Since you questioned the first one, we will question the second one. What we can see here is saying that in 2011, in September, Mr. Schäuble said that we want Greece to stay in.
Yeah, but...
But we know that now we have information that behind the scenes he was saying different things. Now, this is very interesting. In 2012, Hans Werner Sinn proposed a Grexit from the IFO.
Okay. Still proposing.
He said, yes, he said that it would be cheaper to have a Brexit than to bail out Greece.
For them.
And Mr. Schäuble actually insulted Mr. Zinn, saying that the calculations of Milchmädchen is the, like the German girl that collects the milk from the cows, should be left to Milchmädchen, but for professors there are different standards. This was in 2012, when we know that from the former secretary, Timothy Geithner, we know that he again was behind the scenes pushing for the Brexit. And now I think that the markets understood that. And what the markets actually did is they paid very little attention to the public statements because they had the information about what was happening behind the doors. And maybe Paul can explain us better how markets react to situations like that. But I think what has become here, what we have seen here, is that basically markets, after a certain point, considered Brexit very likely and started pricing it in the discussion, in their estimate, in their calculations. So basically what you have is you do not invest in the country, you don't bring money into the country because you expect to invest into the country or bring money into the country after the devaluation that will follow the Brexit. So then you lead the country on the self-fulfilling prophecy. Then you strangulate the financial resources of the private sector, which actually pays the taxes. And then you don't meet the fiscal targets. And that's, if anyone asks me about Quebec, I'll talk about Quebec.
Okay, the question about the Vikings.
Why not bring professionals, Paul? They don't like professionals. They're going to lose their rents. I mean, well, ask Tsakalotos. Ask Tsakalotos. Why? Who are asking me? I mean, not the government. This is the kind of the political system we have. How do you reform their political system? How would the Troika, could the Troika help us? Should the Troika help us to reform the political system? New electoral laws, new constitution. Should? Is it a failed state? Or what? This is the vital question right now. Because as I've shown, I think that the political market now, it's the main impediment of the economy, for the economy.
Yeah, the thing is that anyhow you had weak institutions and the political market with problems. And during the crisis, instead of gaining economic competitiveness, you have weakened institutions even further. And now the real risk in a Brexit is not economic. It's not that it's not going to deliver the economic gains, some argue, like those here on the list, but it is that basically you risk a socio-economic implosion. If you lose the gravitational pull of EU institutions, there is a fear that the domestic institutions are so weakened that they will not be able to withstand the social pressures. So the issue with the Brexit is not economic if you're going to regain competitiveness. The issue with the Brexit is if you have the institutional capacity to stand on your own at this point of time. And that's one of the major differences. I have this figure here where
the
comparison with what is happening in Quebec with the independence movement.
That fits to the
what about Quebec?
Yeah.
What about Quebec? Okay. So
it's very well fits to the political thing. And
what you have
market
is basically data I could get from the early 70s. Before that, there are many differences between Greece and Quebec. But a strong national identity. But it didn't have a like conscious independence movement. But in the 70s, as a combination of economic and political factors, it actually started being an issue. And this is normalized to one, the employment in the rest of Canada, except Quebec and in Greece and the rest of the euro area countries. And you see that employment is diverging. So that Quebec is not having as much employment growth as the rest of Canada. And since the independence movement gained momentum and there was a first referendum it actually never went away, even though they lost here. It didn't move away as a result of multiple, how can I say, political mishaps. But basically, nobody felt the urgency to put the genie back into the bottle. So they let it linger, and then it got entrenched. And here you see what happened with Greece. It actually was gaining unemployment relatively to the rest of Europe till here, and here you have that. So the argument here is that letting these ideas getting entrenched can be very dangerous, because when they get entrenched, then they do not go away. And here, this is interesting. This is from the Fraser Institute, the economic freedom in the U.S., the rest of Canada as an average, and Quebec. So like Greece, it's a more regulated economy. So that means less long-term growth. But it also means that both these ideas of exit affect the more regulated parts of the economy, the Canadian and the European. And actually, Brexit is on a different scale, because England is again diverging from the average, but on the other, on the upwards, going upwards. So the argument here is that if you do not have a minimum of coherence in the economic regulation and economic freedoms across the Union, then you risk that these ideas come out like a spark. And then if you don't pull them out fast, you risk them getting entrenched.
And if they tell you this is about democracy,
yeah,
and you want to destroy democracy because these people voted for the referendum, I mean...
Well, there are big questions here, the ideas stressing before in the presentation about the need to push ahead with the economic union and making sure that economic activity has a minimum obligation of EU law underlies that you have to bring these divergences among parts of the unions closer. You have to eliminate them to have a minimum uniformity of what it means to be part of the union as daily economic activity, which is actually part of the optimum currency area theory. And that's also the fact that Europe has not advanced in the past years. They have done things for the banking union, they've done things for the coordination of the fiscal and the fiscal side, but this part, because it's politically the more difficult one, they have neglected. And again, I say, we're trying to make some minor contributions, marginal contributions in the book on the topic.
Who are the Vikings?
There was this question about the Vikings. Who are the Vikings and why you don't name them in the book?
Well, we do name them so many times in our previous books and our publications. Now, the vested interests, the Olsonian redistributive groups, professors of economics, universities,
in Greece.
Employees, employers, pensioners, lawyers, you can find them anywhere. You can find them anywhere. Rent-seeking is a situation, when rent-seeking is becoming the dominant economic activity, then the most beneficial activity of the people is trying, instead of producing something, to extract rent. And when a system like that is established, it's so difficult to do something about that and change it. This is the kind of the theory that Mankiw Rolston has developed back in the 70s. Who was the founder of the economic analysis of non-market decision-making theory. And that's why he was so, disappointed as far as the ability that societies have to, mature societies have to get their economy back on track and fight all this kind of the distortive groups that, also destroying democratic institutions, etc., etc. So that was a problem, and one could say also that still is a problem for Greece, since production is so small, and most of the people are, still wait money from the to throw out from helicopter, meaning that still there are so many people looking for rents in order to survive today. But back in the 90s and back in 2000 and 2004 and 5 and 6 and even 7, there was kind of, let's say, rent-seeking party in Greece. So that produced also the kind of what Dimitri said about the 12 and 13 and I think more was 15% of GDP, current account deficit, that kind of was reflective to the loss of competitiveness of Greece's economy, reflecting also depicting the how small the productive base of the economy had been done compared to rent-seeking activities. So that is a disease, that was a disease, and that led to the country to the situation that we are, you know, we are now experiencing still now after 7 years of recession.
Okay, let's take another very quick round of questions. Francesco here, and then the lady.
Thank you very much for the presentation. One thing, just a note of caution, when you compare the economic decline of 36% of Greece in the period 2007-18 with the other countries, you forget that if you go back to 2000, Portugal and Italy are completely flat, and they are
almost
the same level as Greece now. So the decline or the GDP per capita is the same as 2000 for both for the three countries, Greece, Portugal, and Italy.
Italy is higher.
Except that Greece went very fast up until 2007. And do you blame in the book this period? How did you build these divergences, these imbalances during the period before the crisis? That's one thing. The other is, could you build the EMU like in the U.S., Economic and Monetary Union, such that we have a banking union, and nobody cares what's happening with Puerto Rico, to cite the example of Schäuble, right? You have problems there, but the banks work okay, the state is failed, and nobody blames the U.S. or the dollar for that, so the union goes on. Or would that be building a different economic and monetary union?
Are you saying that we need a default? No, I mean, just asking.
No, just... If the type of monetary union conditions reform or not. For the rest, I agree very much with the issue of ownership. I think is crucial for reforms in this country.
Okay. The gentleman there.
Just two very quick questions. The first one is, what's your take about the current negotiations? So what do you think is going to happen? And the second question, you mentioned that access to finance was really one of the key issues during the crisis. And he also mentioned that the recapitalization of banks was successful, which is indeed the case. But despite the recapitalization and despite the fact that ratios are pretty high by European standards, non-performing loans are equally high. And how can you see the 40. Adjustment over time? Because that is a major issue going forward. So, I mean, if you have the banks that are not functioning properly, there might be an issue for, you know, for the recovery after the problem.
Okay, last question, the lady at the...
Να απαντήσει για τα MPL.
Ναι, ναι, ναι. Όχι, όχι, κοιτάω. So we say that Greece was rent-seeking
economy back in 2000 to other economies, which the peer, as you say, how much more was Greece? How is it measured? And what do we mean? I don't say who is to blame, but what do we mean by rent-seeking? Because I thought that this was a structural thing embedded in the society and the economy from the old days, but I understood that you blame more the last period more than something deeper.
So the convergence had...
Yeah. I will just talk about the banks, and then you guys talk about everything else.
Okay. Ah, yes, I've forgotten the disclaimer. Everything I hear, I say is in my personal capacity, right? I should have said earlier on.
Too late.
Okay. I want to start out with the structure of the union, because I think this is directly related to these issues, because that's where the uncertainties that affect everything with the banks comes from, and also with the divergence that came before that. So basically, when the European project started, they knew that they would go step by step. And when the time came to implement the common currency, those who implemented it knew it would be an unfinished job, and that their successors would have to do other things to complete the project. And one thing they knew is that you would have to create a more even a playing field of economic activity across Europe. But because this hits at the core of how politics distribute rents in every place of Europe and in the world, not only in Greece, it was very difficult to do this, given that the structure of the European construct. So what happened basically in the United States is that some crazy guys isolated themselves in Philadelphia, they drafted a very nice constitution, and then they took it out on a referendum, and they took away power from the state governments. And what happened in Europe is that national parliaments voted on how much they would give to the supranational entity. And it is no surprise that they did not give away those powers that are critical for the domestic politics, for the equilibria between the political institutions, the domestics, and the voters. So they didn't give these things up. And what happened is that Greece basically already had a weak production base when it came into Europe, and then into the European community at the beginning. And by entering in the community, you removed all the barriers that protected domestic production. But because of the domestic political gain, you didn't improve the business environment. So you removed from the productive economy the protection, the wall, but you didn't create the institutional environment that would make it more competitive. And then, because you were over indebted, the state was over indebted, after the euro accession, you were able to borrow a lot of money cheaply. And what happened is that actually the state borrowed this money. That's why it was indebted more than the private sector. And it distributed it generously. And there's a nice paper by Mr. Maliaropoulos about this, who shows how the state crowded out productive activity. I think these problems, you had them all across Europe, but in Greece they were more acute. And they were a result of failures in the construct of the incomplete union that basically played out in an extremely bad way. And then you have the crisis that arrives, and you're not going to fix the main problem, which is the unevenness in the economic rules for the daily operation of businesses across Europe. I mean, they're not the same in Arizona and in Massachusetts, but some basics are there. The rule of law, more or less, is not questioned, whereas you have very uneven application of the application of law and EU law across Europe in issues that affect the daily operation of businesses. Now, having said that, I want to put this in context with the issue of the NPLs. So what you have, basically, first of all, the NPLs, I have a lot of collateral and a lot of provisions that cover them to a large extent, and people usually do not take this into account. They take it into account for Italy, but it's also true in Greece. And a lot of this collateral, its value depends on the political risk. So if you were to reduce political risk, and if you were somehow to normalize the financing of the economy, and if you were somehow to restore asset prices, and now I'm talking about internal inflation, which the proponents, the militant proponents of internal devaluation, they will not like, but it's something actually that Alexander Hamilton engineered in the US over 200 years ago. So if it was good for Alexander Hamilton, I'd rather take it over the approaches of the proponents of the internal devaluation. Then the problem will shrink in size and quality. Clearly, there are economic activities that will not survive this process, but the amount of those that will be able to recover or be restructured will be significantly larger than it, what a static snapshot reveals you now. And that also has to do with the approach. I mean, there are two approaches. One approach says we've waited enough, flush the toilet. The other one is that you should allow things to stabilize a little bit before and then try to unwind this whole situation. And now some critics will tell you that, but we have waited so long. If we wait longer, it will become Italy. So there are no clear-cut questions there. But my gut feeling is that you should remove the extreme risks of Brexit and implosion before you look at the evaluation of the collateral and the provisions that you can bring into the game to manage the NPLs. And then you should go about unwinding this whole situation. But that's my personal gut feeling.
Okay. Thanks, Michal. That was a very comprehensive answer. You covered many of the questions. We have now minus 10 seconds before we finish the event. So I will pass the floor to Dimitri to answer the NPL question, something on that. And then Thodoris will finish on a positive answer to the question, what will happen with the current negotiations. An optimistic answer to that.
Okay, so your question was about the banks. So you're saying that somehow what can be done to get the banks lending back to the real economy, and especially given that they have all these NPLs. So in a nutshell, the answer is that kind of the banks are keep getting worse and worse just because the economy keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, there have been kind of efforts to fix the banks and efforts to fix the banks, and I will give you a bit more details. But if kind of these efforts have some limit, unless the kind of somehow this decline, kind of there are some sound economic policies that are followed, more and more money will be keeping, I mean, the NPLs will be getting worse and worse, and more we can put more and more money down the banks, but this will be kept kind of being, kind of banks will still have low capital. Just give a bit more color. So in 2013, 31 billion were put into the four large banks. So, and they brought them to some kind of decent capital levels. I mean, you know, not, they were not like super, kind of, how can I say, they were not like super comfortable, kind of comfortably capitalized, but kind of they were at kind of at some kind of decent margin. Then in April 2014, April May, they raised 8 more billion, and this was private money. So fine. Then there was this asset quality review in the fall of 2014, and it was found that they don't need any more capital. So they were kind of at the borderline, but kind of, you know, they had raised some capital. They were, you know, if things were continued to go okay, they would have been, the NPLs would have started going down.
They would stabilize.
So then there was the new election, and Syriza and ANEL came to power. The asset quality review in fall of 2015. Found that they had to realize 10 more billion of losses.
That's because of the capital control then?
The capital controls and all the worsening of the economy that made all the NPLs kind of go through the roof. Then there was the third recapitalization where about 14 billion more were raised. Both 10 private and five public. So, now, the combined stock market value of all the banks, as of very recently, is about 5 billion or 6 billion, even though they raised 14 billion back in the fall of 2015. So somehow it's like a black hole. I mean, if the economy keeps getting worse, the banks will always look bad. Now, let me give you one last statistic, which is that if you look at the ratio of their unprovisioned and non-performing exposures, which is like NPLs, so those that are not covered by provisions, to capital, is 1.8. So it's quite a bit still. But all this, I mean, if somehow the economy starts moving in a good direction, all these things will start becoming better. So it's not the banks that are going to pull up the economy. It's the economy that's going to pull up the banks. So so that's essentially the answer.
Not very optimistic, so let's go to my second attempt.
The elimination of uncertainty and this can have big effects. I mean, some political stability, so...
If you had to blame the period, the 2000-2009 period, yes, sure, it was a period of super rent-seeking activities, and the main thing that has to be emphasized here in this period is the great deterioration especially post 2006-2007, of the current account deficit, which shows the competitiveness of the economy, the worsening of the competitiveness of the economy. Blame EU, yeah, blame what? The maturity of EU institutions, but this is, another talk to be done. It's very important. What is the definition of rent seeking? Is the so-called debt weight loss, this rectangle which is defined by the increasing prices and less product. There has been Gordon Tullock, I think, that he's trying to find some numbers as a percent of GDP. But in my view, the current account deficit reflects the rent-seeking activity that become dominant in the Greek case. And then you see the difference between the exports and imports, which reflect very well the loss of competitiveness of the economy and the very small manufacturing base. What about the negotiations, the current negotiations? The good news and bad news. This is kind of pretend and extend. Pretend negotiating, there is no negotiation, come on. Who is negotiating? With whom? Tsakalotos? Writing down in a room of a hotel, come on. This is pretend, again, as I said, negotiating, and extend. And extend what? The period of the political risk. That is, this delay of agreement, in my view, is killing for real this time, the real economy. It's not like deja vu from the period in February 2015. We have right now a kind of distraction of the real economy. And so the government delays the agreement. So why government delays the agreement? Because in my view, this is the only way that the voters could, let's say, digest at least a part of the political cost that has to be paid by the government. So the good news is that there will be an agreement, but again the risk is to enter to a period of Vangelis Venizelos has said stagno bankruptcy. Can I say that? I mean, it's a kind of an economy which is not recovering, with a very slow growth rates of something like 1%, or even 1.7, 1.8, 2%, which is not adequate to bring down unemployment, which is really a nightmare for Greece, and not only for the youth, but also for the pension system, for jobs, for income. This is the kind of an unfortunate situation we are experiencing right now. But we believe that an agreement will be reached, and then we believe that
everything will be fine.
Happy days.
Okay, on this positive note, I want to thank the speakers. But before I ask you to join me on thanking the speakers and our discussion, let me make two quick announcements.
We believe in a change in the government.
If you liked this book launch, we also have another book launch in 2 weeks' time. On the 17th of March, Thursday, 17th of March.
It's not us.
It's not you. That would be too quick. a book on the financial crisis manual, Reflections on the Road Ahead, continuing on the issue by Platon Monocrousis, who is actually a visiting fellow here at the Hellenic Observatory, and his co-authors. But before that, from next week, starting on Monday, we have something very different, a photographic exhibition,
wow.
Imagine Greece. It is happening in another building here at the LSE. It's open, I think, for 2 weeks. If you want to book for a private viewing, that's happening on the Wednesday on the 9th of March. On these announcements, thanks for everybody for staying until this late time for this, I think, very interesting discussion. Please join me in thanking our discussion. This is the speaker.
Thank you.